Thank you. That reminds me, this series is called, and that in itself reminds me of my friend Ray Cameron, with whom I used to write Kenny Everett shows, television shows, and Ray once said to me, I wish just once I could say something that didn't remind you of something else. It's my butterfly brain, it goes from topic to topic. That in itself, again, reminds me of dear Kenny Everett, my friend. He always called me Bar, which is probably from the place he usually found me. And I always remember Ev said to me once, he said, ooh, Bar, you, married for over 30 years and 4 children, what a smokescreen. Now, you know your status as a performer by the amount of notice you get for these things. Peter Ustinov requires about 6 months, dear Frank Muir required 3 months, David Frost requires a month. So you can imagine what a thrill it was that I was sitting at home watching television last night and they asked me to come and do this. It isn't really a life story, it's a meander. If I won't give you my full CV, my biography, you'd lose the will to live. But I was born in Leeds in 1900 and typing error. I'm a BA in Lit, failed of Leeds University, which is absolutely true. I failed due to the outbreak of the Second World War, which was 16 years before, but upset me very deeply. And no, I'm the full Bronte. And that reminds me, Leeds. Alan Bennett was at Leeds Modern School and I was at Leeds Grammar School. And we never met in those days. And we subsequently met years later and became friends. And he collects lines overheard in the street and things of people. So I always ring him if I hear lines. And years ago, you remember The Madness of George III, his play, and it was retitled The Madness of King George. You probably know why. They thought the American audience would think George III was a sequel. And but when it was called The Madness of George III, it was on at the National Theatre, and somebody told me they were at a dinner party, and a couple said, we went to the National last night, and somebody else said, what did you go to see? And they said, The Madness of George III. And a woman on the other side leaned over and said, what was that about, Thora Heard? Now, so I thought, if anybody should hear that story, you'd get the picture, it's Alan. So I rang Alan and told him. And he's this almost silent laugher. It's very strange. And all you hear on the phone is, And a few days later, I got one of his immaculately written postcards that said, rehearsals have just commenced for The Madness of Thora Heard. The curtain rises to the clash of Zimmer frames. I was in the street in Cambridge once when I was doing panto there at the Arts Theatre, and a very earnest woman scurried past me talking to a man, and as they passed, I heard her say to the man, when you see Austin this afternoon, remind him there is no main verb in that sentence. That got an appreciative Feeling a bit low, actually. Our granddaughter's hamster died yesterday. Fell asleep at the wheel. We're here, dear listener. Dear listener, we're in the German Street Theatre, and this whole area reminds me of the heyday of the real old London nightclubs around here and Soho and across the way, off Bond Street. I met Terry, my wife, who's here today, in Winston's nightclub in Clifford Street, off Bond Street, in the 60s. And the name is an interesting origin because a wonderful character called Bruce Brace, who ran Winston's, used to work at Churchill's in Bond Street. And he left Churchill's and started a club called Winston's. There we are. And Danny LaRue held court there, was reigning supreme, and then subsequently had his own club. And I always remember Danny one night in the club. There was a very effusive lady. He was a very good host and would circulate around the tables after the show. And this woman got rather carried away and said, do you enjoy dressing as a lady, Danny? He said, not much, dear. Do you? Now, oh, I'll tell this one. It'll be a good edit. During the Second World War, our lads were in Norway in near Arctic conditions, and they had this short Sten gun, which was notorious for freezing up and jamming overnight due to the sheer cold. And one of the lads took a certain product from a company that supplied a social service, what we would call nowadays a condom, let's be quite frank, and stretched it over the barrel of the Sten gun overnight. And in the morning, he peeled it off the barrel, and the gun fired first time. This became a legend, and it went right up the chain of command that this actually worked. And it reached the great man himself, Winston Churchill, and he sanctioned that the company would manufacture an 18-inch model for this express purpose on two conditions. One, they are clearly marked made in Britain. And two, medium size. Our dear friend Ronnie Corbett was in the shows at Winston's and at Danny Roo's nightclub, a man of some wit and style himself. Danny always called him Cary Grant on his knees. And I was present with David Frost and Ronnie, and of course Ronnie had become a television name through the Frost Report originally. You might remember quite a few years before the two Ronnies had their own show. And David had been instrumental in getting Ronnie Corbett into that show, and Ronnie was ever grateful. And David put the bite on Ronnie one day when I was there, and he said, Ron, he said, the 17th charity show, Drury Lane. And Ronnie said, I'm sorry, I can't, David. He said, are you working? He said, no, no. Are you playing golf? He said, no, no, I'll be at home, David. It's my only day off around that time. And then David tried the emotional blackmail. He said, no, it's me talking, Ronnie. He said, I haven't exactly been a hindrance to your career, have I? And Ronnie said, you certainly haven't, David. You've elevated me to a position from which I am now speaking to you. Oh! Ronnie's mum and dad came to see the show at Danny's own club in Hanover Square, which by then was the most successful club in London, and people came from all over the world, and Hollywood stars, and Burton and Taylor, and Noel Coward used to come. It was a wonder, Judy Garland, a wonderful era, and Ronnie's mum and dad came down from Edinburgh, and Danny, as ever the perfect host, got them a very good table and champagne, and they had a wonderful time. They saw the show. Then Danny and Ron and I joined them, and of course, Danny was just reigning supreme in this club in London's West End, and Ronnie Corbett's dad was so overcome by the whole experience. He looked round this rather small club, actually, smaller than where we are now almost, with a little round marble floor where we used to do the show, and he looked at Danny, he said, you're wasting your time here, son. I always remember that. Pursed lips are the words I'm looking for. Oh, that reminds me of my butterfly brain. I think of Ronnie Corbett, the diminutive Ron, and I think of my oldest man called Revel Barker. Isn't that a great name? And he's about 6 foot five, 6 foot six. He's a journalist. And I was with him one night, and a woman was very taken with this huge, enormously tall man, and she was twinkling all over him. And she said, oh, Revel, she said, are you all in proportion? And he beamed at her and said, no, love, if I was, I'd be 9 foot ten. Now, I think it was Revel who told me about the courier taking American tourists around Stratford-on-Avon in the coach with the open top and all that, and they came to the lights, the green man crossing, and beep, 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 and then one of the women in the party said, well, what's that noise? And the courier said, well, that's the crossing light, the green man, and she said, why the noise? He said, well, that's very helpful for blind people. She said, my God, blind people aren't allowed to drive in the state. Where are we? Oh, writing through the years. I've written four and indeed two. A lot of the comedians through the years. And I love stories about writing. There was a very good series years ago written by Charles Wood about a scriptwriter played by George Cole, and it was called Don't Forget to Write. And I saw the first episode, and it was very good. And I was talking to a guy the next day, and he said, did you see that thing with George Cole about the scriptwriter last night? I said, yes, I did. He said, did you like it? I said, I thought it was excellent. He said, so did I. Must have been written by a writer. Now, think about that for a minute. There's a logic there somewhere. Funniest line ever about a writer, though, was the a great man called Fred Emney. Big, fat, amazing figure with a monocle and a cigar, and I worked with him, and he was a wonderful character. And there was one of the many revivals of J.B. Priestley's When We Are Married. I think it was back in the 70s. And Fred played Orman Royd, the photographer, and he had a wonderful bluff voice. And they had the dress rehearsal, for the sake of argument, somewhere like Guildford. And they did the whole play, and the only audience was the great Jack Priestley and the director of the play. And they finished the play, and of course the curtain didn't come down. They just stood on the stage like Madame Tussauds. And for reasons that were later explained, J.B. and the director got up and walked out. And from the stage, Fred Emney's voice said, "Well, if he didn't like it, he shouldn't have written it." I love that. I might tell that again in a minute. Somebody said to Victoria Wood, "Where do you get your ideas from?" She said, "I've no idea, but if I ever find out, I'm going to live there." And, you know, that's the way you feel. Friends, writing friends. Spike Mullins, a great man. He used to write Ronnie Corbett in the chair on the two Ronnies. He was one of the few script writers other script writers kept quoting. He's full of great lines. One of his great lines that we all remembered was, "My great-great-grandfather died at the Battle of the Little Bighorn." Well, when I say he was there, he was actually picnicking on the other side of the hill and went over to complain about the noise. Another dear friend getting married very shortly, David Nobbs, he of Reggie Perrin fame, he and I wrote for Les Dawson a lot and did a lot of scripts together. And I remember David, quite emotional one night, late one night in a restaurant in Leeds, he said, "God, I hate show business." And his wife said, "You love it, that's what you hate." And wrote that down on the serviette. Oh, David Nobbs told me he was once hauled into a police identity parade. This is true. And it was a case of a flasher. This is a true story. And David Nobbs said, "You can imagine the police sergeant's face when he asked for my name." Now, for no reason whatsoever, I've just remembered a story I read in a book somewhere about Kingsley Amis, who was staying at a friend's house the weekend. And he woke up the first morning with a burning bum. It was on fire. He had no idea what was happening. And it's not the most convenient location to see what's happening. So he crawled out of bed. He thought, "Is it a boil? What is it? This is so painful." And there was a full-length mirror in the door of the wardrobe and a small mirror on the dressing room table. So he stood in front of this full-length mirror, reached behind, got the other one, was trying to angle it to see what was going on. At that moment, his host walked in with a cup of tea. "Morning, Kingsley." And Kingsley Amis straightened up out of embarrassment and realised he wasn't holding the small mirror. He was holding a picture of his host's wife. I always remember this story. Jonathan will know this one. Jonathan Cecil, listener, he's in the front row, about the old actor being interviewed, and the interviewer said, "Do you think Hamlet slept with Ophelia?" He said, "Well, I usually do." Now, critics and put-downs and all that sort of thing. I heard a Noel Coward story I hadn't heard before. I think it was on the wireless. Noel Coward had got a very slating review for one of his later plays, and he wrote to the critic and said, "I'm sitting in the smallest room in the house with your review in front of me. In a moment, it will be behind me." Oh, dear. No, put-downs. People often think in our game we're floating around in a pink cloud, and you never are. You never are. David Vine told me this, a skiing commentator and sports commentator, as you well know. He said he was at a conference. He was sort of hosting a big business conference, and he was standing around before the whole thing started, and a girl came up with a very big glossy brochure, you know, one of those big lovely ones with the sort of red cord as a bookmark and everything, and proffered it to him, and he took it from her, and he wrote, "Best wishes, David Vine," on the front. And she said, "I'm selling them." Now, I mentioned Kenny Everett earlier, and we were filming with Ev outside St. Thomas's Hospital here in London. And filming involves, as you no doubt know, a lot of standing around and hanging about. And a man who worked at the hospital came up to me and said, "Gee, is your autograph, Bell?" And I said, certainly. He said, you didn't think I was serious, did you? Now, this gets better, this story. 3 weeks later, I was in a cab going over Waterloo Bridge. Well, not going over it, going across it. Otherwise, it'd be a much more dramatic story. Going over Waterloo Bridge, and I spotted the hospital downriver, and it reminded me, and I was having a chat with this taxi driver, and I told him that story. And I said, the guy then said, you didn't think I was serious, did you? And the taxi driver laughed and laughed. He said, oh, imagine that happening to somebody well known, he said. Michael Parkinson tells a story of the book signing. I've gone into this league, very small league in my case, but the book signing, when you've got a book out and you go to bookstores and you sit there, you know, with the piles of books and hope there's a sort of deluge of people. And even a big name like Parky, it does happen. There are lulls. And I think he was in Manchester and Michael was sitting at the table, pile of books, and he said, you write a bit and you talk to assistants, you drink a cup of tea. What you're really covering up is the fact that nothing's happening. Nobody's coming up with a book to be signed or anything. And he said, in one of these lulls, there were two women standing about 6 feet away from him, making no attempt to approach him whatsoever, and talking about him, audibly. And he said it was quite unnerving, and they were talking about him as if he wasn't there. And one woman said to the other, he doesn't take daylight, does he? Tom O'Connor tells a story. He was in Blackpool and a woman pointed at him and said, it's you, isn't it? And he said, I preened myself and said, well, she said, are you coming back to finish that bathroom or what? I think the legendary Hermione Gingold had the beautiful story. She was on Broadway and she came out the stage door and there was a gaggle of autograph hunters and she's signing autographs and there was a little girl there with her father and she heard the little girl say, what's that lady for? Now, I think that should be written up on everybody's wall. Keep a sense of proportion. After dinner speaking, which I was doing last night at Shrigley Hall, sorry to place drop, outside Macclesfield, and the adventures of after dinner speakers are many and various. We all compare notes with each other on the circuit. There's one great story about the guy who gave an after-dinner speech and then sat down, and the man next to him said, that's the worst after-dinner speech I've ever heard. And he was very upset. The man on the other side leaned over and said, take no notice of him. Got no opinions of his own. He just says what everybody else is thinking. Oh, and I must tell it. I must tell it. You can all join in the end. Community joking. Story of the Toastmaster, those figures in red coats who control everything. And there's some after-dinner speaker droning on and droning on. And, of course, the people are looking at the Toastmaster who's standing in the gloom behind the speaker, signalling, shut him up, get him to sit down, we've had enough of this. And he thinks, what am I going to do? And he thinks desperate situations demand desperate measures. So he's looking along the table and he sees an empty wine bottle. And he thinks I'll move along quite casually and pretend to trip and I will accidentally hit him over the head with a bottle. So he glides along the table, but he got the bottle, overdid the trip, and he hit an old man next to the speaker by mistake. And the old man said, hit me again, I can still hear him. Basil Boothroyd, a dear man who I met in my occasional writing for Punch days. And dear Basil, he said, oh, I don't do the after-dinner thing. He said, but I do speak to the WI's Women's Institutes. And he said, one particular day, he said, it was fascinating. He said, I was doing my usual piece. And he said, very mobile audience. He said, just after I started speaking, a woman got up and went out. And I carried on. Then she came back. And as soon as she sat down, another woman got up and walked out. And he said, this happened all the way through, constant passage of ladies in and out. And he's having a cup of tea with Madam Chairperson afterwards, and she said, oh, we did enjoy that. He says, a very mobile audience you've got here. She said, oh, Wednesday's the chiropodist. And I can't even mention after dinners without my dear friend and partner, Willie Rushton. What can I say about him that he wouldn't interrupt? Will and I used to follow each other around the after-dinner circuit, and I was at a dinner one night, and the man said, "Is Willie Rushton a friend of yours?" I said, "One of my oldest, yes." He said, "We had Willie last year doing this." He said he was at the top table eating his dinner, and Sir Charles, our chairman, sitting next to him, giving him a lot into his right ear, talking away to Willie, and Willie was eating his food, going, "Good Lord, yes, I can imagine." Finally, this man said, quite loudly and rather rudely in front of the whole table, "You'd better be funny tonight, Mr. Rushton. We're paying you a lot of money." And Willie said, "Well, most of it's for sitting with you." Willie told me the story when he was in Bernard Miles' production of Treasure Island at the Mermaid Theatre years ago. He played Squire Trelawney, and an actor called Eric Flynn played Dr. Livesey, and it was the first week. Bernard Miles was on the side of the stage. He hadn't made his entrance yet as Long John Silver. And Willie had this long speech about this malevolent, fiendish sea cook. And Willie said he wasn't on top of the words. He hadn't really... And, of course, he could keep talking all night, but it was only a passing acquaintance with the actual script. And he was waffling away about Long John Silver to Eric Flynn, who's thinking, "He's gone, he's all over the place." And it was crucial that Willie mentioned that he was a one-legged sea cook. That was rather germane to the greer at that point. And Willie said he just ground to a halt. He couldn't think of anything more to say. And he said, "This is one of the great prompts of our time." He said, "Eric Flynn looked at me and said, 'How many legs has he got?'" Rushton, of course, said, "You being a medical man would know. You know, you can't, you couldn't." What can you say about a man who described John Major as a man who thought charisma was December the 25th? And he attributed Margaret Thatcher's behaviour to prime ministerial tension. Oh, yes. What was his bits of advice? "Never go to a dentist with blood in his hair." I always remember that. "Never go on holiday to a country where they still point at planes." Cheers, Will. No, you envy your idols and the real wit and style I love. I heard Alfred Hitchcock interviewed on the radio years ago, around the time when Psycho had been out and caused a great stir and scandal at the time. And he said, "A woman wrote to me and said her daughter, after seeing Psycho, had refused to take a shower. What can I do about it?" So I wrote back and said, "Have her dry cleaned." Billy Wilder, a great man. Oh, it was allegedly Billy Wilder, I think, who... to this day, he's probably in his late 80s now, and rich and revered and very famous, but he's still hustling. He still wants to get a film off the ground. And the alleged story of Billy Wilder meeting a young film producer, and they were chatting away, and the young producer said, "Excuse me, Mr. Wilder, could you tell me what you've done?" And Billy Wilder said, "The fair question, you go first," which I thought... Dear Roy Castle, used to tell the story. When stardom first struck him, he was at the London Palladium, and he was living with friends in Denham. And he would dash out of the Palladium stage door after the show, up Argyle Street, dive down into the tube, and get the Bakerloo line to Marylebone, and thence the train to Denham, probably the last train, a late one after midnight. And he said he did his usual dash up to Marylebone this particular night, and there were the old trains with the doors you could open yourself, you know, real safety hazard looking back, and the old compartments. And he jumped in and closed the door, and he said the usual suspects were in there, asleep or reading, whatever, the late shift crowd. And he said just before the train left, the door was flung open and the archetypal city businessman got in, bowler hat, briefcase, umbrella, London Evening Standard, shut the door, put all his stuff in the rack, sat down and fell asleep. And the train set off. And then the train, as trains do to this day, stopped for no apparent reason between stations. clunk. This man woke up, jumped to his feet, got all his stuff out of the rack, opened the door, and stepped out on the embankment side. And the door was swinging in the night. Then again, as Roy said, very British, nobody said anything. Then the umbrella came back on its own. Then the paper, the briefcase, the bowler hat, then the man's left hand, his right hand, then his face appeared, covered in muck from the embankment, a burgeoning black eye, blood from the nose. Climbed in, shut the door, picked up all his stuff. Of course, now they're all looking at him. He said, "You must think I'm a terrible fool," and stepped out the other side. Oh, another Roy Castle story. Remember, he used to do Record Breakers, and Roy told me this, and it was set in Ireland. It was the largest musical chairs in the world, an attempt at the record. Scores of chairs and scores of contestants, bands, choirs, a huge crowd, and this built up to a wonderful, exciting climax, all these people rushing around, and music playing. And Roy said he'll never forget the very last moment. One man circling two chairs. Lines, people say. Peter Cook, who a man of wicked wit, but who could be very patient in a social situation. Peter apparently cornered by a man who was going on and on, and Peter was nodding politely and everything, and then there was a lull, and Peter, trying to nudge the conversation, said to the man, "What are you doing at the moment?" And the man said, "I'm writing a novel." And Peter said, "Neither am I." Which... Only the other day, just one last one, only the other day I heard the story of the train in Northern Ireland. In our strife-torn world, it's lovely to have some warmth and mirth, and there's a man rushing down the train in Northern Ireland saying, "Is there a priest on this train? God's sake, is there a priest? It's an emergency. Must be a priest on this train. Is there an Anglican vicar? Anglican vicar. Is there a rabbi? Please, emergency." And the little man put his hand up and said, "I'm a Methodist minister." He said, "Ah, oh, you're no use to me. We're looking for a corkscrew." Thank you very much for your company. Tell me where you're working next week and I'll come and see you. Thank you.
Now, there's an offer you can't refuse. That reminds me, Barry Cryer was produced by Claire Jones.